You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although he grew up in a Romanian labor camp, Peter Georgescu embodies the American dream. He eventually came to the U.S. and worked his way up to become CEO of a major Madison Avenue ad agency, Young & Rubicam. His life experiences have made him think a lot about the nature of evil, both political evil and even evil in the boardroom, and he's called his memoir, which is to some degree a meditation on evil, The Constant Choice, An Everyday Journey from Evil Toward Good. It's published by Greenleaf Press, written with the help of David Dorsey, and I'm very pleased that it brings Peter Georgescu to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a joy to be with you.
You were born at the start of World War II?
Just about as the war started.
And how soon afterward was your father arrested?
He was arrested, I believe, in just the late 1940, early 1941.
So how old were you at the time?
Well, just a couple of years old.
So you probably don't remember much.
No, I don't remember that part of it, other than the fact that we were separated from my mother and father. We went to live with my grandparents in Transylvania while Dad was in prison in Bucharest.
And why was he arrested?
Well, he was the general manager of an oil company, Exxon today.
Standard Oil.
Standard Oil of New Jersey, exactly. And he was manager of the Ploiești oil fields, which were, in fact, the Saudi Arabia of Europe in those days. In fact, the Nazi war machine ran on Ploiești oil fields, and the biggest Second World War battle took place over the Ploiești oil fields for that reason.
And you describe yourself as being happy during these early years, somewhat unaffected by your father's absence. Did your grandfather tell you why your father had been arrested?
I was too young to understand that. And they created an island of security and peace around me. And so I felt love. I felt nurturing. And the actual war, the grist of war didn't really touch Romania because the parties that be who took over were pro-Nazis. And so there wasn't a great deal of blood and guts fighting around me.
Mm-hmm. And your parents gave you a very optimistic view of the world.
My grandfather was a politician, and he was one of the good guys, and he was one of the people favorites in town. I would walk down the street holding my grandfather's hand, and people in those days, everybody wore a hat, so the men would tip their hats and the women would bow to my grandfather as he walked by. So I was in the presence of a really highly respected man of integrity.
So your father worked for Standard Oil, and since that was an American company, did that help or hurt when he was in prison?
Actually, the Nazis made a huge mistake because they took all the Allied prisoners, including airmen who would crash land. And they put them all together. And a very long story that's outlined in the book is the story of how my father, in fact, worked with the OSS. And a couple of times they used to fake crash landing to get a prisoner into that prison. Malmaison was called. So they can help conspire. And, in fact, they concocted a coup, which, in fact, was put in effect in the early part of 1944.
So there was a resistance cell, literally.
Literally, there was a resistance cell. My mother was a courier also for the OSS. So they had lots of adventures in those days.
Was your father in danger of being killed, as
well,
many prisoners were?
He faced the firing squad literally twice. And then by the German orders. And then and then Antonescu, who was a Romanian top dog, decided to spare his life because he was a little ambivalent as the war years progressed as to whether the Germans were going to win. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to maintain some relationship with the Allies.
So he saved your father.
Saved my father's life, literally.
A matter of realpolitik.
Absolutely, precisely.
When he was released after the war, he lobbied the Allies to send military force. This is to Romania to protect it against a Soviet takeover. That didn't happen. And then Romania, of course, disarmed, but they probably couldn't have resisted the mighty Soviet army.
Well, you see, the deal was made at Yalta, and the fate of Romania was pretty much agreed to. And in the book, I talk about an unfortunate incident with then-Ambassador Averell Harriman.
He's the industrialist and financier, had
exactly.
a distinguished career as a diplomat. He was also governor of New York State.
Yes, he was. And there's the park there for us to see it. Unfortunately, he didn't have a very good day when he came to see my father, and the prime minister met with him. And they asked him, they said, look, we will not disarm. We will do whatever it takes. We'll fight. I'm not sure they could have won anything, but they could have resisted in those days. Who knows? But he was a little bit loose with truth. He said that he was at Yalta all the time, and there was no deal, and there was no separation between the Soviet camp and the Allied camp.
Now, do you know whether he was making these decisions on his own, or was he just following orders from Washington?
I can't speculate on that. The only thing I can tell you that when my father tried on number of occasions to meet with him, he would never see my father.
Although he did stay with your family at one point.
Oh, in Romania at that time. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, the United States had a record of that. We promised other countries that if they rose up against the Soviets, we would come to their support. It didn't happen in East Berlin. It didn't happen in Hungary. It didn't happen in Czechoslovakia later with the Prague Spring. So perhaps we shouldn't be surprised.
Well,
the United States did not want to get into a hot war.
That's exactly right. And I think you used the word realpolitik. And that was part of and this actually, in a way, goes to the issue of good and evil. And why, you know, where's the desire to or we feel the need for this deceptive perspective about life and how we deal with life and how we deal with each other. It's part of our culture. It's become part of our culture.
Well, do you think that Harriman knew he was lying? Do people tend to be fully aware of when they're doing something that might be considered evil or immoral or deceptive or whatever? Or do you think they always find a way to rationalize their actions?
Well, it is hard to imagine that Harriman didn't know what was going on in Yalta, since he was a man of, as you said, a prominent diplomat and a prominent figure.
He served five presidents.
He served five presidents, and it was highly respected. And so it's almost unimaginable that he didn't know. That's all I can say.
How did this affect your perception of the West and of the United States in particular?
It did not. It did not. I later learned that sometimes good people do terrible things, and this may very well fall into that category. So I'm not so judgmental about it as it pertains to one single individual or one specific action.
My guest is Peter Georgescu. His book, The Constant Choice, An Everyday Journey from Evil Toward Good. So when the Allies didn't send help, did your father have a plan for your family?
Actually, they were somewhat optimistic. Remember that Averell Harriman promised that the Allies would support free elections in Romania, and they would stand behind those free elections. So although there was some level of insecurity, the Romanian government decided to disarm, and free elections would be held against the communists, who were not particularly popular at that time. And
but you're just going from a fascist government. Usually countries wind up going in the opposite direction, don't they?
Well, they did, but the communists weren't going to win an election in Romania
at
the time. A fair election. That's exactly right. And so I think to that degree, there wasn't a red flag. Maybe there was a flashing yellow, so to speak, in colloquial terms, but it wasn't a red flag. And that's what took him to New York in early 1947. He came with my mother for a two-week visit at headquarters to talk business with his leaders.
And then shortly afterward came the takeover. You don't describe it as dramatic or violent, but rather as a subtle obedience. How do people become susceptible to what you call organizational evil?
Well, people actually did not know. Unfortunately, the force of evil has a tendency to sneak into situations, and it's like boiling, you know, the proverbial frog. It starts with lukewarm water, and before you know it, the frog is boiled.
What happened?
Well, they came in with promises of some idealistic state of communism, which was to everybody would have their fair share of the society, and there would be greater amount of distribution of wealth, and people would be treated more fairly, and good things were going to happen to everybody. And so it was under the cover of all kinds of beneficial promises made, which of course were not kept.
And then your parents couldn't return.
Well,
but why weren't you and your brother sent to join them?
Well, first of all, it was the Iron Curtain fell during the 2 weeks that my father and mother were in New York, which in retrospect turned out to be a blessing. Because if they would have been in Romania, we would not have the dialogue today. My parents would have been killed, and obviously my brother and I would have been killed as well.
Your grandfather was 80 years old, you said,
just about,
very respected,
yes,
when he was rounded up and taken away in the night. Why was he considered a threat? He was just an intellectual.
Well, he was an intellectual, a former politician, and a leader of sorts. And that was the fear of the communists. They knew that sooner or later their lies would be, in essence, found out, and then that an opposition would form. And so they rounded up somewhere north of 200,000 people.
He's 80 years old.
He's 80 years old.
Hardly a threat.
Well, who knows? They were paranoid. And they knew they were going to run into troubles. So their method of dealing with that is to eradicate any potential opposition, whatever.
And what
he was highly respected. He was highly loved.
And what happened to your grandfather?
Well, he was arrested and then taken to a prison in the small town of Siget. The birthplace of Elie Wiesel, by the way. I just found out because I took my grandkids to visit his prison. And he was in his cell one day. They forced him to clean the floors, and a guard came in for whatever reasons, so they told us, and kicked him in the face until he died.
You discovered at a certain point that you were related to Pavel Bucu.
Yes.
Who had been a peasant leader who was murdered for leading an uprising against the Turks early,
right.
I guess a century before.
Right.
Do you think that this opposition to government was something in the genes in your family?
Possibly. I would credit. Certainly, I would credit my grandfather having the same kind of tendency. He fought very hard. He was in the Austro-Hungarian Parliament for a long time because Austro-Hungary really controlled Transylvania in those days before the First World War, and he was arrested and jailed 30 times for protesting. And in essence, causing trouble for the Hungarian parliament.
This is during the time of the Ottoman Empire.
No, this isn't the time of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Oh. Yeah.
My guest is Peter Georgescu. His memoir, The Constant Choice, An Everyday Journey from Evil Toward Good, is published by Greenleaf Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We are back with Peter A. Georgescu, who arrived in the United States in 1954. We'll talk about what happened before that. He went on to become the CEO of Young & Rubicam, the major ad agency. He has written a memoir with the help of David Dorsey called The Constant Choice, An Everyday Journey from Evil Toward Good. It is published by Greenleaf Press. When did you become first involved or interested anyway in religion? Because that's another theme of this book.
Yes, it is. I had this duality of concerns throughout my life. I wanted to know from my early days in Romania, why do people do these terrible things? And in fact, by the end of my youth and later on in life, I just couldn't let go of this. And what was fascinating to me and why I was so obsessed with the notion of evil is because I saw the other side of our natures. We are a compassionate species. We are kind and loving and caring and compassionate. And we can do absolutely magnificent things. So then the question in my mind was always, how come?
But not everyone has as dramatic a life story. Parents, a father sent to prison and by the Nazis, and then later a grandfather killed in prison by the communists. You and your brother were sent into forced labor camps.
Yes.
How old were you?
Well, I was probably around 9 and a half, 10 years old at the time.
So you were a major threat to the government.
Yes. They knew they had to put us somewhere, to park us somewhere. And they decided, well, the little demons, so we're not going to treat them too nicely, you know, let them work. And then we'll figure out what to do with them. Either we're going to kill them, or maybe they will be useful to us.
But they also interrogated you.
Oh, yes.
What did they want to find out?
They really, I don't really know. They obviously knew there was, we couldn't talk to anybody. We couldn't do anything. I think they were really brainwashing sessions. They were absolutely determined to tell us that our parents were evil, that our parents had deserted us. They left us in this miserable thing. It never occurred to them to suggest, well, why do two young kids clean sewers and dig holes for telephone posts if this regime cared about, you know, being treated nicely.
And then you and your brother decided to adopt a kind of we'll show them attitude towards your work. So you worked harder even though you were malnourished and exhausted?
Yes.
And well, did that have much of an impact?
It had an enormous impact on us and zero impact on them. They couldn't care less. But you know, at that point in time, that was to be the rest of our lives. There was no hope. There was no chance for us to ever get out of that situation.
And did you feel abandoned by your parents who were still in the United States?
Not at all. Not at all. We knew very well. That's the huge advantage of having our grandmother with us, who was not forced to work. She was an elderly lady. She stayed at home. And in at home, home meaning one room with a bunch of hay. That was our bed. And so we would talk, and she was able to share with us the realities of the world and in fact, the kindness and thoughtfulness of our parents. We know that our grandfather was arrested, et cetera. So there was no question in our minds where the white hats were, where the black hats were.
Were you ever afraid that being a good person like your parents and your ancestors would lead you to become to death?
Not really. No, never occurred to us. It was in those days that I developed a spiritual / religious model. And that basically said that this world was populated by good guys and bad guys. And these were very clearly the bad guys, and they were proving it every day. And
but that's a black and white approach. But bad guys sometimes do good things and good guys do bad things.
That was not part of my model. My model was clearly the bad guys do bad things, the good guys do good things, and it was very simplistic. And it helped. And that's why it said that working harder reinforced in us psychologically and gave us the strength to endure.
Did things change after Stalin died?
You know, it was, I remember hearing on the radio, and it was a sense of glee and joy because clearly Stalin was the driving force of the atrocities that we had seen and endured. I had no reason to believe that things would change, except I felt elated by the fact that this man was gone.
When did you learn that your father had been offered your safe passage to the United States in exchange for collaboration with the communists?
We never heard that, of course, in Romania. No. That we only learned that retrospectively. We never knew that the Romanians had blackmailed our father and mother with saying, you either spy for us or we're going to kill the kids. That was unknown to us.
And he had to make a very difficult choice there.
It was an amazingly heroic choice. Can you imagine as a parent?
For him, yes. Maybe not for you.
Well, okay. That's exactly right. You know, but where's the principle come into play in here? That is about as tough a test for integrity and honesty as I think I have ever heard in my life. You either play with us or we're going to kill the kids.
But they didn't kill you.
No, well, they didn't, but because the strategy that was concocted with the help of the FBI at the time was for my parents to go public with the story, and the theory was that if you create a global support for these two poor little boys stuck in Romania, that they would be afraid to kill us.
And that's what happened. It became an international story.
Yes.
And eventually a deal was struck. You were exchanged for a Russian spy.
Something like that.
Were you aware of that deal?
No, of course not. No, no.
What did you think was going on?
No, we knew nothing about this. We knew nothing until they came to us and said, you're going to rejoin your parents in America.
And
so
then,
it was as simple as that.
And then you arrived in America in 1954, moved into your parents' apartment on the Upper East Side.
Right.
I'd imagine there was an incredible culture shock.
It was huge. You can't imagine. First, the buildings, the physical, well, landing at so-called Idlewild, meaning Kennedy Airport, and seeing,
no, that was LaGuardia, Idlewild.
No, it was Kennedy.
You're right.
It was Kennedy.
Right.
And it was funny. There were 100 photographers there flashing their lights and the whole bit and TV cameras and interviews, microphone in your face. It was like a circus. And, it was a serious culture shock.
And you didn't speak English.
Not a word.
So actually, you've done very well with the accent. But because how old were you?
I was 15.
Yeah, that's usually past the point.
Yes, yes.
And you wound up going to Phillips Exeter Academy.
Yes. Well, that was a gifty. Again, this is the kindness of total stranger. This is a demonstration of the good side of our beings. The principal of Exeter, William Saltonstall, a great man, called my dad up and said, we're going to keep a place for your son. And dad even protested the other way. He said he hadn't gone to school for about 4, 5, 6 years. He doesn't speak any English. And he said, well, it's April. He'll learn. Come and see me in August, but I'll still keep the place for him. So we went in August. God bless him. He liked me. And he said to me, young man, he said, if you pass courses on your own, by the end of the first year, you get to stay. If not, I'll find the right school for you. Is that okay? I hadn't a clue what he was talking about. I said, of course it's okay.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking to Peter Georgescu, who grew up, was in a Romanian work camp when he was still 8 or 9 years old, later became an advertising executive. We're talking about The Nature of Evil. His memoir, The Constant Choice, An Everyday Journey from Evil Toward Good, is published by Greenleaf Press. I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. When did you decide to go into advertising? How old were you?
I was in my second year at Stanford Business School. I had already an offer from Exxon to join Esso International in those days. And all I had to do was to graduate from business school. And one day, the placement director, who became a friend of mine, importantly because I wasn't hustling him for a job, said, you have to do me a favor. You have to go see this important executive that's coming from New York, and only one person signed up, so we have to have him keep coming back. So you're going to go and sound very interesting in his company. And so I told him, well, if it's not too early in the morning, I'll be delighted. So I went to see this gentleman, and I knew nothing about advertising. I knew nothing about this company. But he told me what they did, and it fascinated me. They said, you have to learn to respect the consumer, and you have to join the research department, and you have to learn about how people think and their values and their needs and all the rest of it. And then we create these communications for our products.
Was this Y&R?
This was Y&R. This man was a Y&R guy.
You're one of those rare people who stayed with the same ad agency all the way through a career.
38 years.
But you know that a lot of people think that modern advertising maybe not be evil, although there are some cases where it might even be called evil, but it's often considered immoral and deceptive. Didn't you face any moral dilemmas while you were at Y&R?
Yes and no. Mostly no. I think it's an issue of culture. As we will both agree, good people do bad things sometimes. No question about that. But there was a culture of Y&R of trying to do the right things. I can cite any number of occasions. I remember when Warner Lambert came to us with a pair of sunglasses to be used under the brand of Arthur Ashe, and they said, "Study this and give us a recommendation. There will be a big budget for this." And we wanted Warner Lambert business. They were huge in not only pharmaceutical, but gums and all the rest of it. So we were dying to get in. But we did our study, and we concluded the research clearly showed that it would be a terrible idea. It wasn't going to work. So what do you do? Do you go up there and say, give us the $20, $30 million budget, and know that likely you're going to fail or not? And not only me, we recommended that to management. Management agreed, and we went and told Warner Lambert, don't do it. By the way, later on, a year later, we got lots of business from them, but who knew? So you get tested.
Well, often the ad business was you get a client, you get commissions for everything. There would be an ad on, 35% or something like that? And then
15%.
50?
15.
Oh, 15. Anyway, and then, okay, the client leaves, and you get another one. But you decided to have to remove the commission-based approach.
Yes, I did, because I realized that this was, well, obviously much later on, and the cost pressures on agencies and the cost pressure on the client side became intense, and I knew that long term it was not going to be viable to just be on a commission basis. So the idea was, let's share on success. So yes, they had to pay us a basic fee, but let's share in success. If we win together, we win together, and we win as well as the client would.
I don't know if I should read this because it's a little too congratulatory, but Roy Eaton, who worked with you at Y&R, just called to say that your humanity infused the whole company.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you so much.
Now,
I'm touched.
We're going to get to something a little uncomfortable.
Please.
You became a strong believer in silver mind control. You believe in psychic phenomena. there's a whole new agey side to your approach to religion. What did your colleagues and what did the clients think?
I don't know that I broadcast it. I certainly didn't keep it secret, but I never broadcasted my spiritual nature. And by the way, spirituality, if you go back in time, in religious times, mysticism was very much a part of most religions, and it still is. So to some degree, it's an exploration about, higher consciousness. And in fact, most rituals and religions, in fact, call it meditation. Silver mind control was nothing but meditation, basically, mm-hmm. by any other name. And so they're part of the same thing.
But did you apply your spirituality to your business practices?
I think they affected me enormously. As many politicians said, you cannot separate your fundamental beliefs about life from how you conduct your life. And so it was, if I had to pick a hero for me, would be Jesus. And I'm not a Jesus freak, so to speak, in the colloquial sense of the word. But the man, what Jesus said and the way he lived his life, hugely impacted the way I lived.
The Prince of Peace side of Jesus.
Exactly. The Prince of Peace, caring for the poor, doing good in life. That's what the man was all about.
You have visited Auschwitz, Berlin, the killing fields of the Khmer Rouge. What were you looking for in those places?
I wanted to grasp emotionally what that was like. What did that feel? And both places had an enormous impact on me. Enormous impact on me.
Well, many people have problems reconciling the God as a benevolent creator and a world where there is just so much misery. There have been how many genocides during the 20th century?
Yeah, an amazing amount. If you just look at Stalin, back to Stalin, he massacred over 30 million of his own people.
And Mao and Hitler.
And Mao and Hitler and Pol Pot. And exactly.
And
exactly.
There have been other instances as well throughout the world. Yeah. There was the Armenian genocide.
Yeah. So how's that all work out? Yeah,
and some people actually feel that they get more religious and others lose their faith.
Well, you see, I needed to create, and this is part of the searching that went on through my mind, I needed to create a new model for myself. The good guys, bad guys didn't work. So I concluded that this force of good was so powerful. I experienced the benefits of that goodness throughout my life. But I also had to find out, where did this evil come from? And that was the secret for me. The breakthrough for me is when I came up with my own hypothesis for myself where evil came from.
And where does it come from?
Well, it comes from 7 million years. Let me repeat that. 7 million years of living as bipedals in the African plains with the most ruthless predators. They were our neighbors. So that's where we learn to be violent and ruthless and deceitful and mean-spirited and nasty and angry and lose control so that we can fight and so forth. 7 million years of DNA wiring, neurological wiring, and those instincts are deeply ingrained in us today.
And you believe we can actually change some of that?
Absolutely, I believe we can change
epigenetics.
That. Well, epigenetics. But first we need to, but I think and I hope that by understanding where this original sin, by the way, speaking of religious terms, I believe that the original sin of mankind is the 7 years, what happened in 7 million years of encoding this ruthlessness and the nastiness.
Well, we're pretty much out of time, but I do want to ask you the big question for everyone in dealing with these kinds of issues. The choice between right and wrong is often ambiguous. So how should we make a more informed choice?
Well, I think the first point is that many of the issues that we confront us are not quite so ambiguous. They're quite clear. If you believe in the cause of the good, if you believe in compassion and caring, if you believe in that there's some responsibility we have towards one another, as we saw in the aftermath of Sandy, look at what people did. This is the good part. If we can consciously choose that and reject our negative impulses, wow. We move the ball forward.
On the other hand, Cardinal Mahoney in Los Angeles, a very highly regarded man, much loved. He protected sexual predators for years because he felt that it was important to protect the church.
Well, that gets into the very delicate issue of the difficulty of good and evil. And I would say that institutions over the long term are only going to survive if they choose the side of the good, if they have integrity, if they respect the common sense and, as I said, the good part of our natures and condemn the evil as we should. And we should condemn, whenever we see it on public collision, the lying, the cheating, and all the rest that is going on, I think it's time for us to say tilt.
Are you still in the ad game?
No, I'm not in the ad game.
Writing books. This one, The Constant Choice, An Everyday Journey from Evil Toward Good, written with the help of David Dorsey and published by Greenleaf Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me. ¶¶